Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. Our nation continues to grapple with the problem of violence in the streets. Particularly in danger of being wounded or killed by violence are young black men. One of the highest rates of homicide in the country is now in Baltimore, Maryland, where about 170 people have been killed already in the first half of this year. One man is determined to do something to stop the bloodshed. Dr. Carnell Cooper is a surgeon who has worked hard to save the lives of people with serious gunshot wounds. After years of trying to save lives in the operating room, Dr. Cooper decided to also take action to prevent violence in the community. He is here with us today to tell us his story. Dr. Cooper is the Senior Vice President and Chief Medical Officer of Dimensions Healthcare System. He's Vice President of Medical Affairs at Prince George's Hospital Center. And he's Clinical Associate Professor of Surgery at the University of Maryland School of Medicine and Shock Trauma Center. He is also a classmate of mine from Yale. Dr. Carnell Cooper, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you, Eleanor. Thank you for having me.
I so appreciate taking your time to be on the show with us. I feel a little guilty taking you away from the operating room where you're saving lives, but I'm hoping this platform can help spread the word about some of the great work you're doing. So you started your career as a surgeon, right?
That's correct. I'm a trauma surgeon, which means I take care of the patients who are injured, your car crashes, falls, gunshot wounds, stab wounds, those kinds of injuries.
Right. And what happened that made you want to do something more than surgery?
Well, I began my career at the University of Maryland Shock Trauma Center, which is actually the busiest trauma center in the country.
Wow.
Perhaps in the world. The trauma center sees over 8,000 patients a year who are victims of injuries. Again, car crashes, falls, gunshot wounds, stab wounds, et cetera. And it has a stellar reputation. The university and the trauma center are committed to the care of the injured. But not only that, they're committed to the training of personnel, nurses, physicians, physician assistants across the board in how to take care of the injured as well. And it does a great job with a very good, very excellent survival rate. So when I came there in the early 1990s as part of my training as a fellow, I was very excited to be a part of it. And it indeed was a wonderful experience. But what I noticed there was that almost none of the patients that we saw from car crashes to falls or nonviolent injuries ever returned to the hospital with another type of injury, such as a fall, a car crash, et cetera. That was a very rare occurrence. However, patients who had come to our trauma center with violent injuries did return at a very astonishing rate. And this is true of trauma centers around the country that I found as I began to look into it. At our trauma center at that time, the recidivism rate was someplace in the low 20s, 23-22% of return rate. But as I began to look, and that bothered me because, again, I these were young, healthy, predominantly African-American males who we were saving the first time, and when they came back the second time, we often could not save their lives. And when they came back the second time, they came back with another violent injuries. Again, not true of those patients who came to our trauma center with blunt injuries as car crashes or falls. So we began to ask the question, why is that? What could we do different to stop this astounding recidivism rate? I should say that our rate was of return was someplace in the 23, 25, 22%. But there was data from other trauma centers that had recidivism rates, some as high as 30 to 60%.
Oh my God!
Again, of of violent injuries were returning to this, to trauma centers with the same type of injuries. And so that's what started us down down this road of asking what could we do different? Because the trauma center, again, has a star rate with all those other type injuries. We're an academic center. Why? What could we do different? What can we what kind of study could we do? What kind of program could we institute to look at this? So being an academic center, what we did is say, let's ask a research question. That's what we do. Mm-hmm. That's what we in academics do. So we ask the question, what is it that puts these patients at risk for being victims of violence? And if you ask your audience who are listening to us this afternoon that question, they probably tell you, they could probably easily rattle off four or five or ten things that put our young people in our communities for at risk for coming back to our trauma center with violent injuries. They say things like poverty. They say things like lack of jobs. They say violent neighborhoods, substance abuse, et cetera. But and when we looked at this, however, no one had done a real research. There was data on it, but no one had did a real good study to ask that question. So we did a very simple question. We looked at our patients who were coming in our trauma centers with from car crashes and falls, and we asked them questions like, what neighborhood, what kind of neighborhood do you live in? Have you ever been abused? Do you have substance abuse problems? Have you ever seen anyone in your family be killed, et cetera? And we asked that question also to patients who were admitted to our trauma center again for at least the second time because of a violent injury. And we compared the two groups. Folks admitted to our trauma center because car crashes or falls compared to folks who admitted to our trauma center for a second time because of violent injuries. And what we found was that the patients who were admitted to our trauma center for violent injury were more likely to come from poor neighborhoods. They're more likely to have seen members of their families being abused or murdered. They're more likely to have been abused by abused themselves as children. They're more likely to come from a single parent homes. They're more likely to have a low income. They're more likely to be unemployed, down the road, And so those were the things that we found put them at risk. We published this in one of the our national journals, and then we said, okay, now we have a data that says this is what puts them at risk. What are we going to do about it? And so we then began. We used this data to develop what was a hospital-based violence intervention program, because our thought was while they were there in our hospital, we had an opportunity to address some of the issues that we have found put them at risk. Now, Eleanor, as you can imagine, that we're a trauma center, we're a hospital, and most of the issues I just outlined to you aren't really social issues.
That's right.
So the question was, okay, how do we
intervene?
Yeah, exactly. And we as a trauma center, like most trauma centers around the country, don't have those tools to address these particular ones. But what we did was we put the folks in the room who we thought could put together a program, and we knew we needed a social worker, we needed someone who dealt with substance abuse, and we needed, of course, folks to help do a study to study this as we did it. And essentially what we did, make a long story short, is we put together a team of folks consisting primarily of a social worker, of a case worker, and what we decided to do, we said, okay, if we're going to put together a program, we have to study this as well. We can't just put it out there and say, let's start doing it. If we're going to convince other trauma centers around the country that they should be investing in trying to put together a hospital-based violence intervention program, we have to have data that shows that it works. So we, again, did a study. First of all, we put the people who are going to be a part of it, a social worker, some substance abuse people, as I said, and case workers. And what we would do is we would – every time someone came to a hospital who was a victim of violence. And we want to address the folks who was the most challenging for us in our study. They had to be someone who had been admitted to the hospital for a second time because of a violent injury. We would see them at our, we would see at the bedside. We tell them that we have a program that we want you to, that we want to do you to join, that's interested in preventing you from coming back to the hospital program. So what we want to do is, if you don't have your high school diploma, we want to help you to high school. If you don't have a, if you don't have a skill training program, we will help you get into a skill training program. If you have a substance abuse issue, we're going to help you get into a substance abuse program, et cetera, et cetera. We primarily developed a program that would address them where they are and move them forward.
So now who was eligible for this was just the people in for the violent wounds for the second time?
Not the first time. And the reason we did that, Eleanor, in the study was because we thought that if we looked at folks who came in for the first time, they may have been someone who was sort of at the wrong place at the wrong time. You know, just happened to be, you know, at a party, accidental, et cetera. But when you are, when it happens to you for a second time, you got to think that there are some risk factors that put you at risk at that point.
Right, and also I would think with limited resources, you want to target those resources. And another thing, I mean, what you don't want to have is an incentive for people to pretend they got a gunshot wound so they could come in and get your skill training.
Right, exactly. But certainly, you're exactly right. And so we wanted to focus, and we that would take away one of a potential criticism of the study. That is,
right.
Everyone knows that there are folks who just, you know, who happen to be at the, again, the wrong place at the wrong time. So if it happens to you a second or third time, and there are individuals who were in our study who actually happened to be in a third time for a violent injury. So again, by targeting those folks who are in for at least a second time, we prevent those folks who were just wrong by the second time. And we essentially and what we did, we compared those. Once we told them about the program, we then essentially we didn't randomize them. We told them about the program. We didn't say they were automatically in. What we then did was we essentially went upstairs, had a little hat that had intervention program versus non-intervention program. We shook it up and we would pull out the name, and they got the intervention program. They were in our program. They did not. They got the usual treatment that every patient in our hospital got who was a victim of violence. And we followed the patients in the study out after they left the hospital. If they went to rehab, we followed them in the community. We followed some of them to jail if they went to jail. But our goal was to address the issues that put them at risk of being a victim of violence so that they didn't come back to our facility. That was our primary goal. We followed them for 3 years, and what we found was that there were 55 patients in one group and 44 patients in the intervention group. And essentially, to make a long story short, the patients who got our program were much less likely to come back to the hospital because of a violent injury. They were much more likely also to do, like get a job. They were also much more likely actually to be involved in criminal activity. Now, when we did this program, we weren't looking at criminal activity. We're a trauma center. We're looking at just recidivism rate, but what we noted, because all the patients in our program were on probation, it gave us a way of following them. We were able to note that they were much less likely to be involved in criminal activity, much less likely to be convicted of any criminal activity as well. So our program not only impacted the recidivism rate to the hospital, but also it impacted criminal activity activities as well. And we published that, again, it's been a few years ago now at this point. But the bottom line was it showed that a hospital-based violence intervention program could reduce the number of patients who are coming back to our nation's trauma center because of a violent injury. But it also impacted their ability to get jobs, their ability to be involved in criminal activity, reconnection with their family as well.
That's really exciting. When you say it, it sounds so commonsensical, and yet it isn't being done. And it's like the hospitals are out there operating autonomously, just focused on the medical health side of things, when, as you say, the major factors behind why is someone a repeat victim of gun violence is a whole set of social economic issues that create the context that drive them back into your emergency room. So I just think what you did is brilliant. Thank you for doing that.
Well, thank you. And you point out your points are well taken and very important ones. And it points out the way that our nation's hospitals and trauma centers function. Violence is seen as a criminal activity, and it is not seen as a disease. And what I see and what others who do some of the work that I do feel that violence is a public health issue, and that it is can be seen as a disease. If you look at it from the perspective of our children modeling what they're seeing in their neighborhoods, modeling what they're seeing being done in their community, modeling what their role models are doing, and you add into that the environments where they are gunshot wounds are going off in the middle of the night, bullets are coming through their windows, through their walls, and injuring patients in their own homes, innocent bystanders, then you can see elements of why violence becomes a public health crisis, a disease. And the nation's hospitals and trauma centers are not equipped to deal with. They are living on a very tight budget. Uh-huh. Which they're trying to, with reimbursement for everything they do is at the bare bones. So it's very difficult for them to say, gee whiz, I'm going to put out here $250,000 a year, or $200,000 a year to support a group of people who are certainly saving their lives. I think our data shows that hospital-based violence intervention programs do save lives. But it's addressing social issues, and that's what we have to do more of. We have to move more of the data over and over again that shows that these kinds of programs do save lives. One more thing, I'll add, Eleanor, if you look at, and I think it's important in terms of why, again, hospital-based programs are important. If you look at the data of patients who return to hospitals because of violent injuries, as I said earlier, at our nation's trauma center, 30-60% of all our victims of violence return to a trauma center with similar injuries. But what also is important to note, that when the patients return to those centers with violent injuries, their chances of dying are much higher.
Right.
There was a paper from Lincoln Medical Center in New York about 7 years ago now, in which they looked at just patients with penetrating injuries, comparing the first time admitted at patients, first time admissions to the hospital ED with penetrating injuries, versus patients who came back to the hospital with penetrating injuries, and for a second time or more. And what they found was the patients who returned with a penetrating injury for a second time or more were 10 times more likely to die than patients who came in for the first time. And that's not. There have been other papers as well that have had, and as well as anecdotal papers outlining that when these patients come back to the injuries, they are more likely to die. Now the question is, why is that? Because these are young, healthy patients as a general rule. So why are they more likely to die because they come back with second injury or more? And this paper and others have not managed to answer that question. We sort of put out theories like, well, maybe it's because their immune system is a little depressed because they've been injured before. I will put out there that there are things going on in the community, social pressures or social makeups of the communities that impact this outcome. I.e., for example, you know, when the risk factor, the things that put you at risk for being a victim of violence means that individuals know who you are in that community, and so is it because of the nature of the event that is or the circumstances around the event that are more severe? In this occasion, the perpetrators are making more of an effort because they know this patient has survived in the past. Is it those kinds of circumstances that are making it? Are the injuries more severe the second or third time these patients come in than the first time? We then don't know the data about that, but we don't know why these patients are more likely to die, but they do. And therefore, we have an opportunity when they come in the first time to address these risk factors and hopefully save their lives. In some respects, Eleanor, because these risk factors are high, not only do we have an opportunity, but sometimes I feel like we have an obligation,
right,
knowing that data, to try to address these kind of issues at that first admission.
Absolutely. So what's happening now in your program? Do you still wait until that second time when they return with a violent injury, or can you now admit people into some kind of intervention program even the first time they come in?
Excellent question. And yes, now we see every patient who is admitted to our hospital because of a violent injury, whether it's the first, second, or third time.
And we
see them at the bedside. Again, we tell them what we're trying to do. It's very simple. All we're trying to do is we're trying to keep you from having to come back to our hospital again because of violent injuries. And we know from our data that when you come back for a second or third time, your chances of dying are higher. So we ask them a series of questions, a survey that we've had now for almost the two decades. And it's asking questions about their home, their life, their jobs, their income, all those kinds of things. And we still develop a service plan from that data, the same way we did it in the beginning. And we then have them agree to it. They sign off on, here's what we're committing to in terms of we're going to work together to try to help you get into a substance program or help you find a job or help you get a GED, et cetera. And then we move forward with them together. And we, again, as I said earlier, we see every patient who comes to our hospital who is a victim of violence. And I think that what we found is that the number of patients who come to our trauma center for a second significantly. We don't see that 23%, 22% incident rate that we saw in the past. It has decreased at our hospital, I think in part because of our efforts at addressing these issues with our patients who come in for the first time.
This is really exciting, Dr. Cooper, what you've done. That's fantastic. I mean, you're not only saving lives in the operating room, you're saving lives in the community by having these violence prevention programs in place and helping people and customizing the services you've got to each particular individual, what it is that they need to be able to survive and thrive once they get released from the hospital.
Well, that's exactly what we're trying to do. We as a university hospital are part of the community. And it is part, I think, of our obligation as being members of the community to address issues that involve our community. You know, in medicine now, there's a term called population health that is being bantered about, and that is that Centers for Medicare and Medicaid are trying to get us to do more work on, and that is being responsible for the health of communities, surrounding communities, not just the folks who come through our doors. And I think that hospital violence intervention programs are just that. It's a population health initiative that involves trying to address the issues that are burdening our community. I can tell you what we've done also, Eleanor, as part of it. So when we start doing this initially, we said, okay, we start just trying to impact the patients who are coming into our doors and become patients of ours. But then we said, you know what? What can we do to stop these patients from coming into our community with violent injuries? And Baltimore, like most U.S. cities, has a significant dropout rate at around 15 or 16. And so we asked the question, what can we do, how can we partner with our schools in our area to help them decrease that dropout rate? What can we do to show kids the light at the end of the tunnel that keeps them interested in staying in school? Because mm-hmm. certainly one of the risk factors of being a victim of violence is as lack of a high school diploma, dropping out of school early. And in our first study, almost 75% of our patients dropped out of school before they got a high school diploma. So we did two things. We've created a program called My Future, My Careers, and essentially what we did, we partnered with schools in the community who had kids who were marginal, they felt on the fence about completing school, and we developed a program where every Thursday afternoon they came to our hospital, and we had someone from either nursing school, the law school, or the dental school, et cetera, all talk to them about their career. And what it would take to become a dental assistant, and what kinds of financial aid there was, et cetera, and trying to get them using all kinds of props and other things to get them interested in a particular career. Because if you don't expose our kids in our indigent our poor neighborhoods to what's possible, how do they know what they can do? They don't. Mm-hmm. If no one in the neighborhood is a physician or a nurse or a dental hygienist or a radiologist technologist, how do they learn about those professions? How do they know they can do it? Again, modeling. If there's a model for them that says they can get there, then it's gone. They can see it. They see a road in front of them. There is no model for those kids on how to get to it. How can they reach for a goal that they don't know about? And we've been doing that now for almost ten years. And I'll tell you a real quick and a funny little story. We do it for eight weeks. I said at various each time one of the schools I talked to you about will do a presentation using props, et cetera. And when the law school does theirs, they always do a moot court, which the kids are very excited about because they get to be the judge, the lawyer, the jury, et cetera. So it really is. They get to really be a part of what is a potential career. And my anecdotal story is that at the end of one of these sessions 4 or 5 years ago, we had the 15 kids who had been part of the program for the entire 8 weeks, and I brought into the meeting a nursing student, a pharmacy student, and a dental student who had just finished their training. I had them spend 10-15 minutes talking about how excited they were about now going out into career and how they had struggled to get through nursing school and dental school and nursing school because and pharmacy school because they were from neighborhoods just like these kids grew up in. They didn't come from a lot of money, and it was a real struggle for them. But they got through it, and they were just excited. I got enthusiastic just listening to these three people talk to us about how they had gotten through this very tough curriculum, and now they were where they were, and they were excited. So at the end of when these three people stopped talking, I then came down in front of the kids, and I said to them, "What excites you about what these folks all said?" And I thought they would, because I thought they would say, "Well, their enthusiasm for their career, their jobs, etc." Of course, like most times with adults and kids, the kids just sort of sat there quietly and didn't say anything. Mm-hmm. And finally, one kid held up his hand, and he said, "They are normal." He said, "They are normal." So what he was saying was these three people look like they like my neighbor. They're normal people. They're not weird people. They're not successful and weird people. They're normal people.
They're not superheroes. You don't have to be Superman to finish your nursing training.
No. And they're not nerdy. They're not weird people. Mm-hmm. They're normal. And that was mm-hmm. so exciting. So anyway, I don't mean to go on and on. But that, it shows, again, that what their impression of what successful people were impacted now because they saw people who were successful who looked like them. Mm-hmm. Where they weren't weird people because they were successful. So those, again, are the kinds of things that we're trying to do so that folks, kids in the neighborhoods can see that they are like them. And these were, and the kids in the audience were primarily African-American and Hispanic kids. And the three students who just finished the training were, again, African-American and Hispanic students as well. And those are the kind of things we got to do in our communities in order to show our kids what they can do.
That's phenomenal. And I want to come back to that point about showing the young people what's possible. And I want you to tell us some about your story, what made it seem possible to you to become a surgeon. But before we go there, I just want to ask you, raise the issue. This makes so much sense. You've got the data. You're publishing it. It's effective. You're showing that it works. And you said that one of the challenges is around funding it. So how did you deal with this issue? How do you fund this program when most hospitals don't have, like you say, they don't have $250,000 saying, okay, let's use this for, social services to help the patients who come in with these critical wounds?
Well, it's a very important question, Eleanor. And one of the things that we thought about early on when we went down this road is that if we are going to, we didn't want this to be a one-shot thing where we did a study, got some funding, and mm-hmm. that was it.
It sits on a shelf somewhere and no one pays attention.
Exactly. So that's one of the reasons that we did what's called the study in a randomized prospective fashion because that's the gold standard for research studies. I can tell you that it was a real debate for us doing a controlled prospective study versus randomized prospective study because our social workers were concerned that half the patients wouldn't get the treatment, and therefore mm-hmm. they wouldn't benefit, and that was correct. But again, the reason that we wanted to randomize because it was a golden standard, and I wanted to be able to then reach out to have other trauma centers use this data to make the argument that this had the strictest study design that we could provide, and that's one thing that was important for us in terms of how you look for funding as well, because again, that kind of study design means that your funders, or folks interested in funding you, have the kind of data that makes it possible for them to ask for funding. The other thing is that we measured everything possible, every possible element of it we measured, again, because we knew that if we were going to be able to ask for more money, we had to show data, and data that we could present in various fashions to whoever our funder was. So that's why we looked, we measured data on criminal recidivism, not only just hospital recidivism, and we looked at things like reuniting with their families, getting their GED, time spent in prison. So having all that data is the key to being able to making the argument for funding.
Right.
Because if you can say, well, look, I am preventing patients from coming back to the hospital because of violent injuries. And keeping in mind at the time that we first did this, 80% of our patients were uninsured. And so... And certainly this is obviously improved under the current ACA system, the Obamacare system. But still, when patients are uninsured, it costs the hospital money. So if I could make the argument that, look, I am able to keep patients out of a hospital who are uninsured, you know, that appeals to hospital administrators, of course. Now, obviously, the part that as a physician that appeals to me is I'm able to save lives as well. And I think that appeals hospital administrators as well. They are all about saving the lives of our patients as well. But we have to be smart and practical and understand that their bottom line is important as well. So if I can make the argument that I'm saving that hospital money by keeping them out of a hospital as well as saving lives, then that is where I'm going to be able to get them to be a part of my funding mechanism. But we applied for grants from the federal government, from the state government, from private philanthropy. Anyone who has an interest in this kind of endeavor, we've looked for funds for. And we've essentially had, when we first started out, we were only funded by grants from the outside. As we've shown our ability to save lives and be an asset to the university hospital, they have been kind enough to then be supportive of some of our staff as well. That's why getting data is so important, because if you can show value for in terms of, again, decreasing recidivism to the hospital, decreasing our folks who, again, are usually uninsured from coming to the hospital with violent injuries, then you can then make your argument for funding. And if, of course, we can save lives as well, again, hospital administrators understand that.
That's phenomenal. And I know you mentioned at the beginning of, there that you had the control group versus the group that would get the resource, and that's always kind of a moral dilemma, isn't it, in medicine? You're trying out some new drug that you think is going to be effective at curing cancer, but only, you know, half the people can get it and the other half can't. And if it's shown that it's really working well, you go, well, gosh, I wish I could give it to the other people. But then you ruin your data to show that it actually is effective. You need that control group. But I'm so glad you got the data and that now you can expand the services to more people.
You're exactly right. And I can tell you that when we sat in the room as we were initially designing our study, that was a huge debate that we had. Because it's the social worker. In our design group, it was a little unusual, and I think that this problem in a hospital dressing room is unusual. So in our design group was, as I said, not surprising, departments, the social work, the substance abuse counselor, which was psychiatry at our hospital. We had epidemiologists who helped design the study. We had the police department, the parole and probation, because all our patients were on parole and probation, as a part of being able to help because they were initially the folks who funded our program. And then we had the trauma surgeon. So very unusual to get those five people with into the room and design a study. And one of the, as I said, the debates that we really had for a long time was case control versus randomized study. And with our social workers saying, as you have rightly pointed out, you know, you're going to not give some folks the program.
Right.
And therefore their likelihood of dying is going to be higher.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you there were only three people in the intervention group came back to the hospital.
Fantastic!
Only three. Whereas in the non-intervention group, there were almost 16 people who came back to the pro with violent injuries, and I can tell you of the folks who came back to the hospital, those three came back. Two of those folks came back with lethal injuries. Two of them died. So that social worker was right. She was correct in that what she said. You know, it is one of the things that she reminds me of when I see her now. Because I, of course, being on the trauma surgeon, I was the person who was really most advocating for the randomized prospective study and knowing that risk. But those are the risks you take. I can tell you that to date, our study is the only randomized prospective study of a hospital-based program. There have been subsequent studies that have instituted the program and looked at recidivism before the program and after the program and shown the effectiveness of the program as well. So, and that has happened in multiple institutions as well. So there has been subsequent to our study, our data has continued to be verified in terms of showing how hospital programs can reduce recidivism to hospitals, as well as some of the program studies have also looked at criminal activity and shown that criminal activity can be reduced as well.
Well, given the wonderful effectiveness of your program there, is it serving as a model now for other trauma centers? Or you would hope that every trauma center in the country would now be doing what you're doing. And has the idea been picked up and replicated?
So an excellent question, Eleanor. And I'm happy to say that in about 2009, there was the first meeting of an organization called the National Network of Hospital-Based Violence Intervention Programs. All of us had been working in our silos before then, and we had our first meeting in 2009, and we've had meetings subsequently every year. And this group is called NNHVIP, National Network of Hospital-Based Violence Intervention Programs, and you can Google them and go to. And there's a web as well. But this group of centers, which initially at the initial meeting were nine, is dedicated to the proliferation of hospital-based violence intervention programs. And we've now grown to as many as 34 programs now, all over the country, including two programs in the United Kingdom, and one program and one program in Canada, and one program in South America as well. And so the idea is growing, and one of the things that we continue to work very hard on as we bring new programs into the network is continuing to collect data that supports the effectiveness of the program, because we realize that unless we can show data that shows the work that we are doing is saving lives, that it is decreasing resistance to a hospital, no one's going to care. And so we work very hard to help up new starting programs get on their feet. We don't have much funding for it, but we certainly give them intellectual support as well as data support and certainly emotional support as well. But we are very free in the sharing of all our templates and networks. That we don't put any kind of hold on sharing how we do things. We share all our networks because our goal is simple. You know, how can we get more programs into trauma centers around the country that are going to save lives? And so our next meeting actually is this end of September in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And it's a very core group that's very enthusiastic about our work and very committed to saving the lives of our nation's kids.
That's fantastic. I'm so happy to hear this. And I don't know if you're aware, I wrote that whole book on breakthrough solutions in different fields, which is, you know, similar to take an idea similar to yours in another field and to show that it's demonstrably more effective for the same or less money, but could actually, you know, save lives and save money with better results, and to show how they can be brought around and transform the field. So if I do a redo on that book, I'm definitely wanting to do a chapter on you and your program.
We would absolutely love it.
And I want to circle back to something really important. You said that young people need models, and they need to see what's possible to know that they could become a nurse or they could become a doctor. And in our few remaining minutes here, I would love it if you're willing to share some of your own story of what gave you the sense that you could become a doctor and a surgeon and do this important work that you're doing in the community.
Well, I grew up in a poor neighborhood in Dillon, South Carolina, and I happened to have a counselor in ninth grade who thought that I had some talent. I'd done well in school, and that summer before I went to my ninth grade, they'd heard about a program called ABCR, A Better Chance. A Better Chance was the program that began in the 1960s. The goal of the program was to take kids who had done well in their poor school system and put them in a more academically rigorous school system. Most of which were in the Northeast. There are people like Phillips Andover, Phillips Exeter. And in my particular case, there was a high school program in Andover called Andover High School Program as well. And essentially what you did, and the program still exists, the base is in New York. And essentially, we spent 6 weeks hanging out at Dartmouth or Williams College, taking various exams during the summer. And if we complete those successfully, then they would place us in a program. So I got placed in a program in Andover, Massachusetts. And it was, having come from a school that again had very limited resources, to a school that had all the resources you can ever imagine, and all of a sudden my goal, which was at home, was perhaps becoming a policeman maybe, or perhaps becoming a minister, if possible, all of a sudden the possibilities just sort of expanded. They expanded to the possibility of not only becoming a policeman, but the possibility of becoming a physician, a lawyer, because all the, whereas in my school, almost no one went to college, my community, someone who went to college in my community, everyone went to college in this community, essentially. And so I had never even even heard really of colleges like Yale or Harvard, et cetera. And so I went to Andover and I did well. And I remember when I got my my acceptance to the acceptance started rolling in from all these schools, and I wasn't even going to apply to any of these schools, except my guidance told me that I should, and so I did. And I remember the spring of my graduation year, and I got my acceptance into Yale. And I, again, like a lot of kids in poor communities, I grew up with my great grandmother and my grandmom. My mom had had me when she was 15, and my parents never got married. And they did what folks did at that time; they went off to the Northeast and got jobs. So I grew up with my great grandmom and great grandparents. So I called my grandmom and said, because I was excited because I had just gotten to Yale. I called, hey, mom, I got into Yale, and I was very excited about it, you know, I imagine. And my grandmom says, well, yeah, well, that's great. I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad to hear that. And then she paused for a moment, and you know, in that dutiful voice, like any parent, you know, should do at this time when you're trying to make sure you made it right. She said, now, son, is that a good school?
Right, never heard of it.
And right. So certainly getting into a baby ABC essentially opened my world. It said, taught me what could happen. And, of course, going to a place like Yale tells you, it does the same thing for you. It's an environment that says, that stimulates you, that tells you, do what you want to do, go after, try it. But ABC really opened the doors and gave me that attitude, that perspective on here's a problem, let's try to solve it. And so I'm very, very fortunate to have been able to be a part of that program, and I think we both agree that we were very, very fortunate to be a part of the community at Yale as well, which I think was a real fun place to train.
What an awesome story and a great program. Is that program a better chance? Is that still around and active?
Yeah, yes, it is actually. It is, and I am. They still have. Geez, I don't know how many schools participate now across the country. But when I was in the program, it was primarily schools in the Northeast. But now there are schools, I think, all over, certainly in the West as well. And as the headquarters for the ABC or a Better Chance program now is in New York. They have an annual meeting every June. Attended some of those fundraisers myself, and actually this coming September I'm going to go back, because our program that I was a part of in Andover, Massachusetts is celebrating its 50th anniversary. So I'm going to be going back to be a part of that celebration. It is and even now, as good as schools have improved around the country, there's still a need for getting kids who are again in some poor school systems who are doing well, and giving them an opportunity to get into a system that says that says I'm going to get into college, and that's the real goal of the program, that you want to get these young men and women to college, and the success rate of the A Better Chance program of accomplishing that is just tremendous. Certainly it's in the 90. I haven't seen the latest data, but I'm sure that it's in the at least in the 90s in terms of the percentage of students. students who matriculate at schools who actually finish and go on to a college. And so that's it. And this is the majority is for, you know, kids of all races who, again, who are in poor school systems, who are financially strapped. Those are the folks who get into the program, and it was a phenomenal program for me, and I now support it as much as I can, and I think it does continue to do some tremendous work.
That's awesome. And, you know, I can totally relate. I grew up in a poor family myself. They had never heard of Yale. The only college we knew of was Harvard because we lived in Massachusetts. So, of course, everybody knows Harvard. But, yeah, you know, that was the only college I knew. I didn't know there were more. So it's so phenomenal that there is that program, that it's still going. And that's the same program you had mentioned in a private conversation that Duval Patrick went to, who also came from a poor family and then rose to be the first black governor of Massachusetts. So I'm excited for you, and I'm excited that for us that you got that wonderful training and education experience, kind of kicked open the door to a whole wide world. And look at the incredible work that you've done. And just in a final 30 seconds here, what can our listeners do to help stop violence? Is there a way they can learn more about what you're doing or help fund it or take action in their community? Or what do you recommend for our listeners to take action?
Well, I would invite them to look at our website. It's called NNHVIP, the National Network of Hospital-Based Violence and Victim Programs. And I invite them to Google it and go to the website and see the kind of work that this national network is doing to try to increase the proliferation of hospital-based violence and victim programs around the country. And I think that would be any support that can be done for this would be very, very helpful. But I also think it's important that we, as members of our communities, look at our communities and become involved in whatever way we can to address the issues that impact our communities. As a trauma surgeon, hang out with our police commissioner and our healthcare commissioner, and we work in partnership to try to address some of these issues. And I work with members of the ministry in the community, because even though some of the things that we do may not seem very big, but they may only impact one kid, but wow, that one kid could be the next Duval Patrick for example.
Or the next Dr. Carnell Cooper. And that's all the time we have. Dr. Carnell Cooper, thank you so very much for being with us today and for all your important work. I really appreciate it.
Eleanor, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity.
I have a special announcement for our listeners today. I'm doing a day-long program on Creating America the Beautiful on Saturday, September 16th, all day. We're going to focus on what needs to be done to restore democracy in our country and how to strengthen our personal effectiveness during these turbulent times. That, for more information, go to theoracleinstitute.org and look for upcoming events. In case you've missed any of our other Breakthrough Solutions recordings here, our programs, they're available in the archives. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back next Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor Lacaine with All Together Now.